harassing me because I couldn't close the case without interviewing later. Marty shocked me when she let loose with, "Gary, just tell your FBI headquarters that it is very hard to make and keep appointments or do other normal things when you are so effing smart. You see, Gary, when you are brilliant, like Lader and the rest of these Clinton people are, you don't have to follow the rules that all of us mere idiots follow." I did eventually get the interview with Lader. He was so slick that I almost slid out the door after we talked. Like David Watkins, Mac McLarty, and others close to the president and first lady, he made me think, here's another guy I shouldn't turn my back on. Marty retired soon after my meeting with Lader. She told me, I just can't take these Clinton people anymore. I was sorry to see her go. One of President Clinton's first major reforms at the White House was to replace the antique and old-fashioned phone system. No one had ever complained about the phones before. In fact, they'd seemed to work pretty well, taking the Reagan and Bush administrations through 12 years of successfully handled world crises, including the downfall of the Soviet Union and the victorious war in the Persian Gulf. To many, the White House phone system was more than adequate. It was one of the wonders of the Western world, capable of finding anyone, anywhere, at any time. But President Clinton thought the phone system was impossible because he couldn't make personal calls without the assistance of White House switchboard operators. For most of us, the problem wasn't the White House phones, it was the people who were answering them. Time after time, I would call an office within the White House, only to hear a Clinton staffer respond, "Hello? I mean, public liaison. Hello? Just a minute. Who's this?" Then I had to convince them I wasn't kidding. I really am an FBI agent. Now please put your supervisor on the line. Being put on terminal hold was something I came to expect. I got used to being disconnected, too. When the Clinton staffers weren't intentionally hanging up on me, they were doing it by accident. During the Bush administration, I could usually reach the desired party in less than a minute. In the Clinton White House, it sometimes took half an hour. The ex-takeout pizza guys and gals in the Clinton administration, of whom there were quite a few, did fairly well with the phones. Everyone else seemed to be struggling. We learned later that the real problem was that most Clintonites just didn't want to answer the phone. Early in the administration, a senior Clinton staffer tried to call the vice president at his residence. The call was placed after 9 p.m., and the Veep's schedule indicated that he and Tipper Gore were at home. Even if they'd gone out, staff would be there to answer any call. The phone rang and rang. Nobody answered. Immediate panic set in as White House staff wondered what had happened. The staff called the White House switchboard. The switchboard called the White House Communications Agency, and phone technicians were rushed to the Veep's residence. They went through the gate, walked to the front door, and were met by one of the vice president's staff. The technicians explained why they were there, and Mrs. Gore was summoned. Tipper appeared, and the mystery was solved. Couldn't they see that it was after 9 p.m.? The staff had been instructed to shut off the ringers on the vice president's phones. The Gores did not want to be disturbed after 9. Another of Clinton's complaints about the phones was that the system was overloaded now that so many more people wanted to call the White House. So the new phone system was set up to shred calls. How do you shred a call? Simple. Instead of using human operators, use voicemail that shunts public calls to a call dump. This innovation was instituted at the direction of Patsy Thomason and David Watkins at the Office of Administration, two of Bill and Hillary Clinton's closest friends. More than $27 million was spent on this new and improved phone system that offered each staffer a secret unpublished phone number, a number that even the FBI was not allowed to know. Each personal phone number also had voicemail, but that was secret too. Offices also had a main number where messages could be left in a generic voicemail pool, essentially a mini call dump. So if a staffer wanted to avoid a call from a pesky FBI agent, it was easy. These were public servants, but they weren't very interested in being publicly accountable. The White House also had an email system, and we had computers. But David Watkins and Patsy Thomason saw to it that the FBI office could not hook up to the email system, in spite of our repeated requests. One day, deeply frustrated by my inability to get appointments and meet deadlines, I tried to call Patsy Thomason directly to request a list of the secret phone extensions. The phone was answered by a machine, and the message went something like this. "Hello, you have reached the Office of Administration, main office. Nobody is here to take your call right now. Please leave a message. If you are calling to request a tour of the West Wing, press 1, now. If your call is about, nobody is here right now? It was the middle of the day. Later, I met a good friend in the hallway, a permanent employee who saw Patsy Thomason frequently. Gary, there is no secret phone list." Her eyes swiveled to check if we had been overheard. "Sylvia, it's sure as hell secret if I, an FBI agent, can't get it." "Well, all right, Gary, but please don't call it secret. It makes people around here nervous." The next day, a very muted and intimidated Sylvia called me. "Gary, I passed your request on to Patsy, and you don't want to hear what she said." "Aw, go ahead. Nothing would surprise me anymore." "When I told Patsy you wanted the list, she said, 'Screw the FBI. To hell with the FBI. They're not getting this list.'" In addition to making it tougher to reach people, the new phone system was a security nightmare. The old system was self-contained, manned 24 hours every day. The new system was computerized, and therefore not self-contained. In preparation for this book, I interviewed a White House telephone company official who requested confidentiality. "Gary, as you know, the Secret Service has always had a say in the past on changes to the phone system. This time, they were effectively told to sit down and shut up. The system was installed without any of the usual input or approval from the Secret Service." "Aw, come on, you're kidding. What bonehead cut the Secret Service out of the loop?" "No, I'm not kidding. It was Patsy Thomason and David Watkins who were the boneheads, Gary." I heard many complaints from Democratic congressmen that they could not get through on the new Clinton phone system, and if they did, by chance, their names were often not recognized, and they often weren't called back. Another problem with the new phone system was how to pay for it. On 11 October 1994, it was revealed that more than $500,000 worth of charges were rolled up on the new White House phone system. But since each of the several White House agencies was funded separately by Congress, and no one had arranged for them to be billed separately, there was no legal way to pay the bill with the appropriate funds. While David Watkins and Patsy Thomason tried to figure out what they had done, a White House spokesperson explained it this way. "It's not that we are delinquent, it's just that we cannot legally pay the bill." With the phones now squared away, the Clintons decided to upgrade the White House computers. The Bush computers were IBMs and IBM clones. The Clinton administration preferred Apples and didn't want to waste time receiving training on how to use IBMs. So, new Macs were installed, and the staff who were on hand to train them on the IBMs were fired. The Clintons also fired roughly 24 people from the Office of Presidential Correspondence. The result was chaos. Huge canvas bins loaded with mail were parked end to end all around the halls like some enormous wagon train. Vast numbers of tables were set up and overflowed with mail. Reportedly, more than 1 million pieces were unread, unanswered. Most of it was protest mail. The fired employees would have been an enormous help to deal with it. They were professionals, most of whom had worked for presidents of both parties. And when President Clinton was elected, several came out of the closet as vocal Democrats. Ellen Strickhartz, the correspondence analyst, was one of these. She made no effort to hide her joy at Clinton's victory. She was also one of the first to be fired by the Clintons. The day that happened, she walked around the OEOB literally in tears, stopping everyone she knew, including me, and cursing the Clintons. "I voted for them. I can't believe they've done this to me. I'm a registered Democrat. I have a family to feed, a mortgage to pay. There are no jobs. What am I going to do? No amount of pleading would dissuade Marcia Scott, the Clintons' director of correspondence, from firing these so-called little old ladies. And what was Marcia Scott's connection to the Clintons? She told a California newspaper that she was a former girlfriend of the president and that they had remained good friends. Her friendship entitled her to a salary close to $100,000 and the right to fire loyal public servants. Scott also reported that in the 1970s she'd been a wanderer, driving her old Volkswagen bus from town to town. When the bus ran out of gas, she decided that was the place she would live. Scott's office in presidential correspondence, like every other office in the OEOB, had gone from being immaculate to being a pigsty. At first, Marcia Scott reminded me of David Watkins, because she greeted me with such insincere, excessive friendliness that I felt uncomfortable. Then I wondered whether or not she was violating the Clinton dress code. She was wearing a very short skirt, and, like Sharon Stone in the movie Basic Instinct, kept ostentatiously crossing and uncrossing her legs. But Marcia Scott is no Sharon Stone. After I returned to my office, I told Dennis about the Scott interview and asked him if he'd met her. He had, and she had tried to ruin his concentration, too. In the meantime, the mail stacked up, and then it was gone, just like that. I wondered what had happened to it. One day, as I was taking a bag of FBI memos and duplicate copies of investigative forms to the grinding room in the basement of the OEOB, I found out what happened to at least some of that mail. Stacked in the hallways near the huge shredding machine were boxes and boxes of postcards, telegrams, and letters, most of it apparently protest mail. So this is how they're catching up, I thought, as the people's voice was turned into the people's garbage. Perhaps shredding the mail was the only way they could keep up, as heads kept rolling from the correspondence office. I remember seeing the supervisor of the mail analysis office, a distinguished older woman named Lily Bell, coming out of Marcia Scott's office. Her eyes were red, and she had a Kleenex in her hand. "Lily, what's wrong? Can I help you?" I asked. "No, Gary," she said sternly, her voice shaking. "Just don't pray for something you think you want, unless you are very sure you want it. As a black Democrat, I prayed to God that I could end my career working for someone like Bill Clinton, and I got what I prayed for. And now I've just turned in my retirement papers. I am leaving early, Gary. These people are doing things that are so wrong. Our office used to work so well, and now they've destroyed it. I told them I would stay on to get things working again, but I can't. I'm leaving. I just cannot be a part of what they are doing. It's just wrong." It turned out that Lily had been luckier than Betty Dunn, a long-serving employee of the correspondence office. Dunn was absolutely destroyed by the news she was going to be fired. She called her elderly husband. It was a worse shock for him. He suffered a fatal heart attack. Dunn called her supervisor. "This cannot be happening. I'm losing my job and my husband on the same day." Her supervisor begged Marcia Scott to reverse Dunn's termination. The answer? "Nope, can't help you." After all, they needed that slot. Did presidential correspondence improve under its new management? The short answer is no. To give a parochial example, when the Bush administration sent out a letter of congratulations to a retiring FBI agent, they worked from a general format, but always personalized each letter to make it special, taking account of each agent's individual achievements. The Clinton administration quickly did away with such nonsense. They had one form letter and used it over and over again, simply changing the name of the retiring agent. It was for this and other such time-saving innovations that Marcia Scott got paid the big bucks. Dennis and I soon discovered that appointees could make big bucks in the Clinton White House without any sort of expertise, relevant experience, or even basic knowledge. One day, Dennis entered the office shaking his head and chuckling. "Gary, I just had the most amazing interview with that congressman's wife who got hired as deputy assistant to the president and deputy director of public liaison under Alexis Herman. I nodded. I'd heard about her. Well, we finished the interview. So I get up to leave, and she says, "Do you know what I'm supposed to do here?" I thought she had a question about security or about her pass, but she says, "No, no, no. I'm talking about this job. This job here at the White House. What are my duties? Do you know what I'm supposed to do?" Gary, I just stood there and stared at her. I couldn't believe it. This woman is getting $85,000 a year, and she hasn't a clue of what her duties are. How do they choose these people? It was a good question. One we asked ourselves again and again when confronted by the petty antics of the new Clinton staffers. One day I was getting my lunch in the canteen. The picture was the usual scene out of Animal House, with staffers going first to the drink machine, then ordering a sandwich or burger, all the while sipping their drinks, and then returning to the drink machine to top them off before they sat at a table, of which there were too few. And they stayed there, even after they were finished, while dozens of other staffers, including some elderly volunteers, stood waiting. Now, I knew the canteen manager, a good fellow named Tom. He had told me that his margin of profit was very close, so as to keep prices down. Tom's success at managing the canteen depended on customers who didn't, for instance, double-dip at the drink machines. He clearly was not going to do well with this Clinton crowd. That day I saw a new scam, a twofer. It combined the elements of thrift and good health. The frozen yogurt machine was about 15 steps from the cash register. Near the register was a scale where you weighed the yogurt or whatever else you bought that was chargeable by the ounce, like salads, self-made sandwiches, or self-serve pasta. A man dressed in a business suit, an expensive business suit, and about 35 years old, approached the yogurt machine, selecting the largest cup. I noticed that he had a spoon in his hand. He must have picked it up on his way in. He pulled the handle on the yogurt machine and filled the cup. And then, while he stood in line for the cash register, in full view of anyone who wished to see, he wolfed down as much yogurt as he could. Bernice, the canteen cashier, saw him too, and groaned. There wasn't much to weigh once he got to the scale. I studied his badge to see if I could identify him so I could let his supervisor know about his rude, cheapskate, and dishonest behavior. But his supervisor was Hillary Clinton. He was working for Hillary's healthcare task force. The only way to keep these Clinton staffers honest, I thought, would be to weigh them entering and exiting the canteen and charge them accordingly. But they didn't cheat only on yogurt. The Secret Service has a small gift shop in the basement of the OEOB. It sells gifts to benefit the families of Secret Service agents injured or killed in the line of duty, or in need of funds because of illness or other personal calamity. Craig Livingstone actually had to issue warnings to the Clinton staffers and interns that passing bad checks to the handicapped man who ran the Secret Service gift shop would not be tolerated. For me, that kind of dishonesty, cheating the families of injured or murdered Secret Service agents, would eventually come to characterize the Clinton administration. I wasn't at all surprised when a source close to the White House credit union told me that Clinton staffers' accounts were full of irregularities, and that one senior staff member in the Clinton administration was using his federal credit union account for check kiting while he waited for his FBI background investigation to be completed. I guess he figured that in this White House, check kiting was no bar to getting ahead. Chapter 4. Rose Law North. Rules for Radicals. The fourth rule of the ethics of means and ends is that judgment must be made in the context of the times in which the action occurred, and not from any other chronological vantage point. Ethical standards must be elastic to stretch with the times. In politics, the ethics of means and ends can be understood by the rules suggested here. George Washington's Rules of Civility and Decent Behavior. Superfluous compliments and all affectations of ceremony are to be avoided, yet where due, they are not to be neglected. There was nothing gradual or subtle about the changes at the White House. By the second week in February, Dennis and I and our Secret Service chums knew we were in for what writer John Podhoretz said of the Bush administration, a hell of a ride. Each week, every month, the incidents piled up. The permanent staff was bewildered, and they would often come to our office to unburden themselves of the latest outrages they'd seen or heard. Some of these became public, like the scandal of the Clinton staffers stealing U.S. Navy towels during the president's trip to Normandy. Some were not so public, like the story of a staffer on that same trip who intentionally kicked over a small American flag on a soldier's grave so that when the president and the news cameras arrived, our commander-in-chief could be photographed lovingly replacing the flag. Some of these tales were funny, but most were not. In the best tradition of the White House, these permanent staff members would couch their remarks in the most generous terms, so as not to insult the president or his senior staff. But they would get their message across. The message was, "What the hell is going on here?" What we were seeing went beyond politics. It was a matter of basic standards of civility, of deportment, even legality. Clinton staffers would show up at checkpoints without any identification, or with friends who didn't have any ID, or even, on more than one occasion, with friends who were wanted by the law and would become outraged when the Secret Service denied them access. In one instance, a Clinton staffer came in on a weekend with a group of friends to show off his office and give them a tour of the West Wing. He possessed a temporary access pass, also known as a T-pass, and the rules prohibited staff members who had not successfully completed an FBI background investigation from bringing in visitors. It was a basic security procedure, and for most people, no big deal. But this staffer reportedly lost it when he was turned away. Moreover, he attempted to get the officer at the gate disciplined for enforcing the security policy. Within hours, the rule forbidding uncleared staffers from bringing in visitors was waived. Apparently, one staffer's ego was thought to be more important than the security of the President of the United States. It was also very annoying, apparently, for the T-Pass staffers to have briefcases and bags searched as they went through the security checkpoints. All permanent staffers could walk right through the magnetometers because they had been cleared. The T-Pass holders saw this search and the wait as an insult. They considered the bag searches discrimination. Before long, that rule was also rescinded, even though one Clinton volunteer from Texas was caught trying to bring in a pistol. He wasn't intent on harming anyone. He just wanted to protect himself in Washington, D.C. Every day in the Clinton White House, we were surrounded by people who had not been properly screened or properly searched. To be responsible for security in these circumstances was unnerving, to say the least. In February, I got a chance to bring my concerns to the White House counsel's office because I needed to interview Bernard Nussbaum. The counsel's number one job is to keep the president and the White House out of trouble. Dennis and I saw the White House heading for major trouble down the line if something wasn't done to make Clinton staffers cooperate with our background investigations, and unless White House security policy was enforced. The lead players at the counsel's office were Nussbaum, the White House counsel, his deputy, Vince Foster, and the associate counsel, William Bill Kennedy. Foster and Kennedy had worked in Little Rock with Hillary Clinton at the Rose Law Firm. So had Webster Hubbell, now at the Department of Justice. But most people knew very little about these lawyers, or about the Rose Law Firm. When Nussbaum was announced as the president's White House counsel, I remember that he was referred to as a brilliant New York attorney. All New York attorneys, in my experience, believe they are brilliant, but Nussbaum was already having trouble. It was the day after Janet Reno was nominated to be attorney general. The FBI had not yet conducted an investigation because, once again, President Clinton had announced his choice before the FBI had a chance to look into Reno's background. 3 failed AG nominations in a row? It was a serious possibility. Dennis and I knew we were getting close to Nussbaum's office in the West Wing of the White House when we smelled the cigar smoke. Hillary had proclaimed that the White House would be smoke-free, but apparently Nussbaum smoked cigars in his office anyway. Nussbaum had chairs set up around a coffee table, and he motioned us to sit there. He introduced himself. We spent an awkward moment on small talk, then Nussbaum got down to business. He obviously anticipated our complaints, because he tried to bury us with effusive praise for the FBI, how important he thought our work was, and other bombast that sounded extremely insincere. Nussbaum's heavy New York accent was an interesting contrast to the soft-spoken, gentlemanly manner of Foster, whom I'd meet the following day. Foster was tall, the polite Southern gentleman. Nussbaum was short, pushy, and imperious. As Nussbaum rattled on, he must have noticed by the look on my face that I was not impressed. He said, "Look, we made some mistakes with the Baird and Wood nominations. We have taken steps to avoid making the same mistakes again." "Like what?" I thought to myself. But the AG wasn't as much my concern as the White House staff was. I asked Nussbaum why staff members weren't cooperating, why in some cases they were openly hostile, and why nothing was being done about this problem. He didn't seem surprised by this revelation. Nussbaum assured us that the staff would cooperate. He said he'd advised Vince Foster to let him know if anyone was not fully cooperative. His dismissive tone offended me, so I called him on the Janet Reno appointment. "Mr. Nussbaum," I began, "I have seen no evidence that Janet Reno has submitted any documents to the FBI to enable us to conduct a proper background investigation, but her nomination was announced yesterday." Nussbaum didn't say anything. I turned to Dennis and asked, "Dennis, do you have any paperwork on the Reno investigation?" Dennis, of course, answered no. Nussbaum's face was turning beet red. He stared at me for a long time. I stared right back. I had the distinct impression that he was considering whether he should squash me like a bug. All he had to do was pick up the telephone and have me thrown out of the White House. One call to FBI Director William Sessions, and I would be on my way. I had made a big mistake if I had my heart set on staying at the White House, and I knew it. But the security of the President of the United States was my mission, and I could not stand idly by while President Clinton or any other president had his life put in danger because of the dissembling of a cocky New York lawyer. Nussbaum stood up, signaling that the meeting was over. Grim-faced, he walked us to the door. I knew that I'd made an enemy, a big one. The next morning, I was to meet with Vince Foster. Privacy Act provisions prevent me from telling you about the background investigation of Vince Foster, but I can tell you that he had one, just like everyone else in the White House, and I was the FBI agent who conducted the investigation, at least the part that was conducted inside the White House. I sipped my coffee and reviewed the standard forms that Foster had filled out about his life and background. As part of his responsibilities, Foster would need to see many of the nation's most secret secrets. But as yet, he had no basis for a security clearance. Foster had never been investigated by any agency responsible for national security. Foster was the third most powerful White House appointee after Chief of Staff Mac McLarty and Bernard Nussbaum. But except for the fact that his references were the President and the First Lady, we knew very little about him. What was public about Foster was that he was a graduate of the University of Arkansas School of Law, class of 1971. He was a partner at the Rose Law Firm in Little Rock, Arkansas, and reported to William Kennedy, who was his senior and managing partner at the firm. He was married to Lisa, and they had two sons, Vincent and John, and a daughter named Laura. Foster's father was deceased, but his mother was living in Hope, Arkansas, where Foster was born and reared. His two older sisters, Sheila and Sharon, lived in Washington, D.C., and Little Rock, respectively. Sheila was an attorney who joined the U.S. Department of Justice shortly after Clinton's election. When Foster moved to Washington, he lived with her. Foster's spin investigation would serve to determine Foster's good character, allow him access to classified information, and give him unlimited access to the White House complex. It would also allow him unlimited access to intelligence agencies throughout the executive branch, including the FBI, the CIA, the National Security Agency, NSA, and the entire Department of Defense. Of particular interest to me that morning was the fact that Foster had been at the White House for almost a month, but we were just now getting the paperwork necessary to conduct his investigation. Given his high position, we should have been asked to complete his investigation months ago, so he could have his permanent access pass and security clearance before the inauguration. Foster would need at least a top-secret clearance, and should have had a basic understanding of how the system worked. In addition to being briefed by President Bush's counsel and deputy counsel, he received a full briefing from me about the system on 12 February, after I had finished his interview. But understanding security and agreeing with the need for it are two different things. Foster quizzed me very thoroughly. He was interested in the function of the FBI at the White House, as well as the clearance process. Using composites of troubling cases that I was aware of or had personally handled in the past, I pointed out why it was important to national security and to President Clinton that the staff be cleared prior to granting permanent passes. I reviewed the issues of suitability, physical security, and national security, and I also reviewed how the previous administration had dealt with problems associated with negative background investigations. I left my meeting with Foster thinking that here at last was someone who seemed to understand the need for security. When I saw Foster again a few days later, he asked how things were going. I told him that key individuals, even low-level staffers, were stiff-arming us. He promised to do something about it and asked me to let him know if the problem continued. As a response to my complaint, Foster wrote a memorandum directed to all White House staff, ordering everyone to turn in their FBI forms and make time for Dennis and me when we called. The memo, dated 17 February 1993, was unprecedented. For one thing, it was puzzling to see William Kennedy's name on the memo along with Foster's. For another, that the deputy and associate counsel would have to scold White House employees for failure to cooperate with the FBI and Secret Service was truly amazing. I recall that the memo read something like this: "There are a large number of staff members yet to be interviewed, and only a few weeks left to complete the interview process before your temporary clearance expires. Avoid the last week crunch and the risk of expiration of your temporary clearance." I wasn't entirely happy with the memo. The decision to delegate this troublesome security mess down to the associate counsel level, to William Kennedy, was a big mistake. The responsibility was Nussbaum's, and the staff would have taken the memo more seriously if his name had been on it. Security was still getting low priority in the Clinton administration. George Saunders, the veteran White House security consultant, complained to me that his day had been reduced to waiting for phone calls that never came. George had also been moved from the fourth floor of the OEOB to a former supply room in the Office of Administration. Apparently, David Watkins, in charge of space in the OEOB, didn't think very much of George or his job. I met William Held Kennedy III on or about 22 February. He was dark-haired, mustached, and bulkier than his white long-sleeved shirt wanted him to be. His tie was loose, and his collar was unbuttoned. Kennedy always had a hangdog, forlorn expression on his face, as if he had been set upon, mistreated, or in pain. In hindsight, if anyone appeared to me to be depressed, it was Kennedy, not Foster. I recently saw Kennedy testifying in front of the Senate Whitewater panel. He still had that "you-are-ruining-my-life" expression. I introduced myself and briefed him on the role of the FBI in the White House. I specifically recall telling Kennedy that I had 20 years of experience with white-collar criminal investigations, and that my education and investigative experience was in accounting. He seemed very interested in this information, asking me about what kinds and types of financial investigations I had handled. I told him that I had specialized in investigating embezzlement and political corruption, and had jailed bureaucrats, politicians, and lawyers. I always enjoyed telling lawyers about those experiences. For some reason, it always seemed to get their attention. Kennedy reached down into his center desk drawer and pulled out the Foster Kennedy Memorandum of 17 February 1993. He handed it to me and asked me if I had anything to do with it. I admitted that I had spoken to both Nussbaum and Foster about the problems we were having, and I reiterated them. Kennedy was clearly unhappy. "I wouldn't have written this. I'm not happy with this. Vince should have checked with me before he sent this out." I wasn't sure what part he objected to, but I didn't much care. After all, as long as FBI agents had been ordered by an executive order signed by the president himself to clear the president's staff, I felt justified in supporting embarrassing memos written by a deputy counsel, if that's what it took to get the staff's attention. I began, "Look, Mr. Kennedy." He interrupted, "Call me Bill." Where had I heard that before? "Look, Bill, I understand that everyone is busy, and everyone is reluctant to go through this in the first place. But I've got a job to do here, and it's been very difficult so far. If we can get the new staff off to a good start, we can avoid problems down the road with emergency deadlines and so forth. Rushed investigations are never a good idea. Your staff is acting as if this is personal, or that I want to know about their backgrounds. I don't. All I'm trying to do is get this information back to the president so he can do his job and we can ensure his security. That's all. I wouldn't have complained if I didn't believe we were having serious problems." Kennedy was paying half attention. He always seemed to be distracted by something. "Well, okay, Gary, tell you what. Let me know if you have trouble interviewing anybody, and I'll call them and ream them out." "Bill, I can't do that." "Why not?" "Well, I have to work here just like everyone else. My success is dependent on making the least number of enemies as possible. How long do you think I would last if I called you up each time a senior staff member tried to dodge my interview? They'd find a way to sink me sooner or later. I wouldn't be here very long if everyone thought I was a snitch. Besides, why shouldn't your staffers cooperate with sworn federal officers?" "Gary, look, these people are, well, just a little different from the crowd you're used to working around. They don't like telling strangers about their personal business. They think it's too intrusive. I couldn't care less how anybody feels about this process. It's just too bad if they don't like it. This is the only way we know to protect the president, the White House, and national security. We've been in the White House since Johnson, and this process has been accepted by presidents and staffs since Eisenhower. It's also the law. It's the FBI's job to see to it that these people are investigated, and I'm less concerned about hurting feelings. The White House has standards of suitability. If these folks have that much to hide, they shouldn't be here." Kennedy was surprised by my candor. So was I. But I didn't unload completely on Kennedy, because I couldn't, without alienating him. David Watkins was one of Kennedy's good friends, and Watkins was one of my problems. All of the senior staff were closely tied together in a web of personal and professional relationships. Still, I didn't suspect that Kennedy would be anything other than a help, a cooperative party to enforce the security system. At that time, I could not imagine that Kennedy would actually be in charge of dismantling the security program. The thought that the Clintons would try to get around the FBI and Secret Service was so alien that I just could not have absorbed it. We finished our conversation, but not before Kennedy had let me know that he was not pleased with leaving Little Rock, working at the White House, or getting stuck with this nettlesome security assignment. Soon after that, I saw Kennedy again. I had other background investigations that required his being interviewed. Kennedy greeted me with his usual sad face and southern friendliness. Then he asked, "How's Gary feeling today?" I thought, poor man, he can't keep Dennis and me straight. I must have looked puzzled. He tried again, "How's Gary feeling?" Then it dawned on me. He was asking how I was feeling. Was I about to be hugged here? When they weren't shouting at each other, which they did frequently, the Clinton staffers often talked about their feelings. Kennedy was inviting me to share. "Bill, if you mean how is my day going, I would say fairly well." He didn't look happy with my answer, but if I wanted to complain to somebody about my feelings, I would call my wife, not confess to the associate counsel to the president. Clearly, we were not bonding. I asked him about the cases I was working on, and we took care of business. He cooperated with my questions, and there was no problem completing the interviews. He seemed to be in a hurry, but he indicated he wanted to talk to me some more. He told me he was late for a flight taking off from National Airport and needed to catch a cab. I offered to drive him. On the way to National, he told me he was flying to meet his wife to pick up an adopted baby. It was his second adoption, as I recall. He told me his wife was still living in Arkansas, and he did not indicate when or if she would be joining him in Washington. Our conversation drifted back to security issues at the White House, and I remember it ended with Kennedy saying dismissively, "Let's not stand on ceremony." I dropped Kennedy off at the airport terminal, and he trudged off to catch his flight, still frowning. From the time I met him until the travel office firings, now known as Travelgate, Kennedy certainly worked hard to avoid standing on ceremony, or standing on executive orders, or policy, or procedure, or the law. Kennedy was a close personal friend of Hillary and Bill Clinton, Vince Foster, David Watkins, Bruce Lindsay, Patsy Thomason, and all the other high-level Clinton insiders at the White House. He was also a very close friend of Webster Hubbell, who was already being referred to as the real Attorney General. So he was confident in his power and position. He wasn't likely to be shoved aside. But that didn't mean he cracked the whip on the Clinton staffers to fall in line and cooperate with us. I had the distinct feeling that we were just excess work he didn't want to deal with. Dennis and I were called to a meeting in Bill Kennedy's office to offer suggestions about how the White House, the FBI, and the Secret Service could work better as a team. Dennis had requested the meeting, and I agreed it was a good idea. I told Kennedy that one problem was that the White House Counsel's Office, the spin unit at FBI headquarters, and the field office did not have a collegial, harmonious working arrangement, in spite of the fact we were all on the same mission. I suggested one solution might be for the White House Counsel's Office to host a simple Coke and Peanuts get-together, maybe in the Indian Treaty Room. Counsel's Office could provide a speaker to tell the FBI personnel how much their work was appreciated and so forth. Having everyone in the same room for a friendly gathering might help iron out some of the friction that existed between the parties. Kennedy said he thought it was a good idea and asked me to prepare a proposal, including a list of guests who would attend from the FBI. Dennis was more direct, as he usually was. "Bill, things are really screwed up at FBI headquarters. There are about a dozen things HQ does on a regular basis that, if corrected, could mean a smoother, better, more comprehensive spin for the White House." Kennedy was clearly not interested, but he told Dennis to put the suggestions on paper, and he in turn would suggest them to headquarters if he agreed. Dennis balked at giving him anything in writing. "Bill, you can't be serious. If FBI headquarters or anyone else saw a list written by me telling them that they could do things better, that would be curtains for me. No agent knows more than the bureaucrats at FBI headquarters. Everyone knows that. It's the law." Kennedy seemed amused. "Dennis, do you think that I would ever do that? Just give me the list, and I'll do the rest." For days after, whenever Kennedy saw Dennis or me, he would ask for our respective lists. Something in the back of my mind kept telling me, "Watch out." Kennedy's persistence bothered me. This couldn't be high on his list of things to do. I decided to run the idea by Tom Renegahan, my field office supervisor. Of course, I anticipated that Tom would do nothing. He rarely did anything other than carp about deadlines. But having told Tom about it, I knew I could then tell Kennedy that I had kicked the idea upstairs for action, and I'd be off the hook. I was already having second thoughts about it, Kennedy's interest seemed phony, but I didn't know what his game was. Dennis gave in to Kennedy's persistence. He typed the list of sins on plain bond as a personal note to Kennedy and gave it to him. Weeks went by, and nothing happened. But on the evening of 19 May 1993, Tom Renegahan came down to the White House to review our White House operations and suggest ways for Dennis and me to meet the background investigation deadlines in a more consistent manner. The deadlines thing again, I thought. Tom was very adept at ignoring the real problem. We had our meeting and then took Tom to meet Kennedy. Tom said he'd never spoken to Kennedy, but I wondered. I also wondered how Kennedy had time to see us for what was essentially a social call. But Kennedy saw us right in. There was the usual small talk as Tom and Bill got to know each other. Then a curious thing happened. Dennis joked that one of the best things about his White House assignment was the fact that his supervisor, Tom, could never just drop in on us because of the access pass requirement. Tom didn't have one. Ha ha. Kennedy and Tom didn't smile. Kennedy turned to Tom and said, "That's easy. We can sure fix that in a hurry. We'll order you up a pass today." Dennis looked as if he had just watched somebody run over his puppy. It was not fair of Kennedy to cut Dennis off at the knees like that. It was a clear warning, but Kennedy wasn't finished. A few minutes later, he administered the coup de grace when he reached in his desk and pulled out Dennis's list of FBI headquarters sins. I thought, we're dead. Kennedy handed it to Tom and said, "What do you think about these ideas that Dennis and Gary have given me?" My name was not on the note, but I had agreed with Dennis in our initial meeting with Kennedy that certain simple administrative changes would make things go better, and some of the changes had referred to FBI headquarters. Oops. Tom read the list in silence, while Dennis and I tried to make ourselves as small as we could. I would not have blamed Dennis if he had just got up and walked out. But Dennis believed in his suggestions, and he intended to defend them to the death, or at least to the transfer. Tom stammered as only Tom could. He was trying to support his agents, but he could not. I guess he could only wonder at what the FBI headquarters management would do to him if they found out his agents had gone off the reservation. Kennedy let Tom keep the note, and the meeting was over. He had managed to embarrass us and possibly neutralize Dennis and me in one masterstroke. Smart, but snake-like. On the way out, Kennedy caught up with Dennis and me. I, for one, felt only disgust and anger toward him for setting us up. I vowed henceforth never to believe anything Kennedy had to say. In fact, from that moment on, I avoided him like the plague that he was. He tried to make up. "Look, guys, sorry. By the way, tomorrow you guys are going to hear about something you aren't going to like, but you're going to thank me for keeping you out of it." I turned to Kennedy. "What are you talking about?" "I can't tell you now. Just read the papers. You're going to thank me for keeping you out of this thing. Just read the papers." At the same time Kennedy was meeting with us, D.D. Myers, about 100 yards away, announced that the FBI would be conducting a criminal investigation of the White House travel office. Dennis and I had done just about as much as we could to alert the FBI and the counsel's office to the problems we and the Secret Service were facing with staffers who were uncooperative, deceptive, and potentially dangerous to the president, but we weren't getting anywhere. One problem for us was that the FBI was distracted by its own internal difficulties. FBI Director William Sessions was fighting charges of ethics violations, and the president and the AG were noncommittal about whether they intended to support him. He was eventually fired in July. Director Sessions did not want to leave the FBI, and everyone knew that. So, for 6 months, Clinton had the FBI effectively compromised with a lame duck director. Sessions and the FBI were effectively wounded, if not neutralized. Was it possible that Kennedy, understanding that Sessions was compromised, figured he had the FBI handled, and, as a result, didn't have to take two of its agents very seriously? This scenario would explain why we never got anywhere. In spite of our best efforts and the real risks that Dennis and I had taken, when we complained we were on thin ice, persons continued to be named for posts, and then we were asked to investigate them. This virtually guaranteed that our reports would be irrelevant, because having announced someone for a post, the administration would be reluctant to pay the obvious political and public relations costs involved in retracting his or her name, even if we found something. The president was entitled to have the people he wanted, but this prerogative rested on the assumption that the president would require basic standards of suitability. If a person didn't meet these standards, he was out. But the Clinton administration had very different standards. So, in order to maintain an appearance of propriety while hiring staff that previous administrations would have regarded as a security risk, they needed to keep the security personnel in place while they dismantled the security system. In order to do that, Kennedy disconnected the security consultant, George Saunders, from the security procedures, but kept him on as an employee. To the outside observer, the fact that Saunders was still working at the White House would be evidence that everything was the same as before. Next, and more important, Kennedy had to get the Secret Service out of the business of reviewing the background investigations. The Secret Service insisted it must review background investigations, so that if anything went wrong, it would have an idea of possible suspects. If a staff member had shown behavior in the past that indicated that he or she did not conform to normal rules, regulations, and laws, then that nonconformity, which most security officers would consider a character issue, would be known to the Secret Service. If that nonconformity was severe enough, the Secret Service could raise it with the counsel's office, expressing its concern. If a staff member displayed behavior that was illegal or aggressive or bizarre, then the Secret Service could make a case for denying that individual access, at least access to the West Wing, where the president could usually be found. In the past, the Secret Service had a right to determine the potential dangerousness of an individual and advise the counsel's office accordingly. In the past, there had been no question that the experts, the Secret Service, not the associate counsel, was the agency responsible for security, and its recommendations carried great weight and were rarely, if ever, overruled. To shut the Secret Service out from receiving the SMIN results would change the Secret Service into a reactive body. Without access to the background investigations, the Secret Service would not prevent security problems. It could only react once they had occurred. In other words, denying the Secret Service access to background investigations would mortally wound its capacity to protect the president and everyone else who worked in the White House. Kennedy's problem was that he needed to hire the Clintons' appointees, regardless of character issues that were considered irrelevant by the group as a whole. The yardstick by which persons were selected to work in the Clinton administration was different from any yardstick used by the FBI or the Secret Service. The Clintonites adjusted the White House security system accordingly. During the early months of the Clinton administration, the counsel's office and the chief of staff's office behaved as if they had no idea how to run the security program. They wanted everyone to believe that they were just a bunch of dumb clucks from Greasepot, Arkansas. Dumb like a fox. Foster actually told his wife that the Bush administration had walked off the job and had taken all the memos that could have been used by the new administration to help them run the White House. This was pure claptrap. When Dennis and I met with Nussbaum, Foster, and Kennedy, they behaved as if they had never heard of the concepts of security and suitability. They failed to acknowledge at least three meetings that took place before and after the inauguration, when they were personally provided with more information than they would ever need to staff the White House properly. The fact that the Clintons did everything sloppily and at the last minute was not the fault of the Bush administration or the executive branch permanent employees. During the transition, Bush administration associate counsel Gregory Walden and associate counsel Robert Swanson provided Clinton lawyers Steve Newworth and Cheryl Mills with a detailed explanation of how the entire security, ethics, and hiring process worked. Walden had long been ready for the meeting and wondered what had taken the Clinton people so long to talk to him.